that Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, and they just disagree on how.
We're going to get across that wasteland, and we're going to do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. On today's show, newly inducted National Soccer Hall of Fame member Dr. Joe Macnick joins me to talk about his remarkable soccer journey, including being traded in the 1960s from the New York Ukrainians to the Newark Ukrainians, who changed the I in his name to a Y to make him sound more Ukrainian.
Guys would come up to me and speak to me in Ukrainian. I had no idea what they were saying. Most of the time I figured out they were asking me what the score was, you know, and then I learned the numbers and the Ukrainian numbers and was able to, you know, and sometimes they got it, sometimes they didn't.
All that and more coming up. Our guest today is one of the true Renaissance figures in the history of American soccer. Dr. Joe Macnick is currently the soccer rules analyst for Fox Sports, but his past goes all the way back to being an All-American goalkeeper at Long Island University, a coach who led LIU at age 23 to the 1966 NCAA title game, who coached ice hockey and men's and women's soccer at the University of New Haven, who was an assistant coach on the U.S. men's 1990 World Cup team, a referee who worked the 1988 NCAA title game, a FIFA match commissioner, a director of officials for three U.S. pro leagues, and the creator of the popular number one soccer camps. He was recently inducted as a builder into the National Soccer Hall of Fame. Dr. Joe Macnick, congratulations and thanks for joining me.
Wow, Grant, holy smokes. I mean, that's a lot of history there, and I don't know how you fit it all in, but I guess 60 years, you can manage the time, and I appreciate your doing your homework and your research, because that's some of the things I've even forgotten about. But thank you.
Well, I am so excited to have you on this podcast. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. I've gotten to know you, obviously, working with you for Fox Sports over the last several years, which has been a real pleasure for me. But I want to start just by asking you, how did you get connected to soccer in the first place?
That's a good story. You know, I grew up in New York City in a little Brooklyn neighborhood called Greenpoint, which is very popular now. And there was a park, McCarran's Park. And I was a big hockey fan at the time. Only lived seven subway stops from the old Madison Square Garden. So, and you could get into a hockey game for 40 cents with a Geo card. And, you know, I sat down in an English class in my high school, Brooklyn Tech. And the fella next to me, we introduced ourselves. His name was Andrew Shepardovich. Mm-hmm. And we started talking about hockey. And the Boston Bruins had a Ukrainian line they called the Yuki line. It was Busek, Stasiak, and Horvath. Mm-hmm. And I knew about them, and he was surprised because I followed hockey, like I said. So he said, do you play soccer? And I said, no. He said, well, we need a goalkeeper, and you can come up to the gym and try out. So in my, second semester sophomore year, I went up to the gym, and because I knew a little hockey and angle play and could make a kick save and, you know, had some baseball experience growing up, basketball too, You know, I survived it, the tryout. And the first year, my junior year, I was on the JV. My senior year, I was on the varsity. Brooklyn Tech was a very, you know, one of the stronger teams in New York City. I was along with another player, Ray Klavecka, who became at one time the coach of the Cosmos. He and I then became the first two recruits for Long Island University's soccer program. Wow. And that's how it all began. And, of course, Andrew, my friend who I met in that English class, took me to his club, which was the New York Ukrainians. And I played for them in the juniors and later for their senior team and was the backup goalkeeper for the Open Cup champions of 66. That's where how it all began.
I love how I can read this really long description of what you've done over the years and not mention that you won a U.S. Open Cup, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, back then, the German-American League, which is now called the Cosmo League, it was, along with the American League, the premier league on the East Coast in the United States. Blau-Weiß-Gotchi, New York Hungarians, New York Ukrainians, Greek Americans, all ethnic league playing in places like Eintracht Oval, New Farmers Oval, Metropolitan Oval, Zuriga Oval, a lot of places that weren't even ovals, but they called them ovals, Schützen Park. I grew up learning about a culture that I had no idea about, that even existed. Really got entranced with it, loved every single minute of it. Played first for the juniors, then the reserves, then the first team. That's how I met Walter Chisowitz, and he became a mentor and a friend, which led to so many other things.
Okay. And why don't you just stop for a second and explain who Walt Chisowitz was?
Well, Walt Chisowitz came to America when he was around 10 years old and lived in the Philadelphia area and had a great talent for scoring goals. Back in the early days when Detmar Kramer first came to do the coaching schools, we were in those early coaching schools together, and Kramer appointed Walter to be his successor when Kramer, after a couple years, decided to go back to Germany and coach Bayern Munich. I became like the goalkeeper coach for the coaching schools, and that led to the beginning of the goalkeeper camp. It's all a matter of connections. When MISL started, it was Philadelphia office based, and they hired Walter as a consultant. Mm-hmm. And they needed a referee in chief. Walter knew that I knew hockey and also was refereeing, and that made sense with the fact that indoor soccer was played in a hockey rink. Mm-hmm. And so Walter hired me to be the referee in chief, and I refereed the first game. Pete Rose kicked out the ball in National Coliseum.
Pete Rose, the baseball player?
Yeah, because he owned the Cincinnati Kids. He was part owner of the Cincinnati Kids. It was Cincinnati Kids against New York Arrows, Nassau Coliseum.
Nice.
Then I refereed the first All-Star game in Madison Square Garden, which was a big thrill for me because growing up in New York City. And then later on, Walter was still a consultant for U.S. Soccer, director of coaching, and they were putting together the national team. He wanted me to help with the goalkeepers, and that's how that all began.
Okay. There's so many different directions we can go here. I guess when I see that you got your LIU team to the NCAA title game in 1966, you were 23 years old.
Right.
How did you become a head coach at 23 and be able to even be in a position to do that?
Yeah. Well, I had played at LIU. I played 61, 62, and 63. Back then, freshmen couldn't play in any sport. You had to sit out your freshman year. And then after graduating, I became the assistant coach, graduate assistant, which is normal progress. And I started to go for my master's degree. The head coach's name was Gary Rosenthal, and he was very dynamic, charismatic personality. And a new president came to LIU and recognized Gary's personality and asked him to fill the vacancy of dean of students. Mm-hmm. So that left an opening in what was already a very, very good team. So I inherited, I then got the head coaching job at 23, and I inherited Gary's really, really good team. with, you know, players like Dove Marcus, who won the first Hermann Trophy, mm-hmm. Carlo Tramontosi, who later went on to coach St. Francis, mm-hmm. to really special accomplishments. We went all the way to the national championship game, and we lost to San Francisco with Lothar Arcienda on the mm-hmm. field playing, and we lost badly 5-2 in the championship game. After beating Michigan State in the semifinal 2-2 with the tiebreaker being corner kicks.
What?
Yep. The tiebreaker back then in the NCAA was corner kicks, and we had 7, they had 6, so we went on to the final.
As a rules guy, how do you feel about that tiebreaker? I didn't even know that existed at one point.
Yeah. So it actually, players were actually backing away from shots, letting them get shots on goal, not to give a corner. So I mean, and I remember that all the teams stayed in the same hotel, and Michigan State was on the same floor as we were, and their athletic director and the coach had a screaming argument about how could they lose to LIU, you know, Michigan State being the athletic machine that that it has been versus LIU, which, you know, wasn't doing anything since the basketball scandals of the 50s.
Right.
And so they had a screaming argument. I could hear the coach saying, well, it's a stupid rule anyway. We should have, you know, they should have let us play. So it was a special time, but got us into the final.
Okay. And there's one particular thing I saw once in a story about you that I had to ask, which is you mentioned playing in the 60s. And I noticed in one story it said you played semi-pro with the Newark Ukrainian Sich in the American Soccer League from 1967 to 68, and that the team temporarily changed the spelling of your name to M-A-C-H-N-Y-K to make it sound as though you were Ukrainian.
Not only sound like it, but look like it. You know, Michael Lewis, who is writing a book on the Rochester Lancers.
Okay.
And so they were in the American League when I was playing for the Newark Ukrainians. And the reason I went to Newark to play for them was because, as I told you, I was the backup for the goalie for the New York Ukrainians. Mm. Then Newark needed a starting goalkeeper, so I moved. I got traded. But in the game program, when we played Rochester, up in Rochester, Michael Lewis found that program and asked me if I was the same guy. Is that me? So, yeah. And I mean, people used to, you know, back then in the fields we played, people were standing behind the goal. There was some places, no stands whatsoever. They stood around the field mm-hmm. on the touch line, on the goal line. You know, sure. Sometimes there was a railing, sometimes not. And they were, you know, guys would come up to me and speak to me in Ukrainian. I had no idea what they were saying. Most of the time I figured out they were asking me what the score was, you know, and then I learned the numbers and the Ukrainian numbers and was able to, you know, and sometimes they got it, sometimes they didn't.
I mean, what comes clear to me is for anyone out there who thinks there's not a rich history of soccer in America or in the Northeast or in the New York City area, from before the days of the NASL, there was a very rich history, and it was in many places, is it fair to say, an ethnic history?
No, it was for sure ethnic, and, you know, we're talking late 1950s, early 60s, which is only 15, 20 years after the war.
Right.
So there's a great immigration coming, and many of the Ukrainians, in fact, that I grew to know and play and really enjoy their culture, came through South America. They couldn't even get directly into the United States, wow. And some through Canada as well. And I mean, some of the games ended in, some of the games never finished because of the carryover and the hostilities from the war.
Oh.
Yeah, so, I mean, there were some, you know, brutal experiences that I remember, you know.
Where, any specifics?
Well, I don't want to go into, but, I mean, there's been blood. I've seen, you know, wow. On the field, and it comes over from the fans getting involved. Ukrainians, anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 Ukrainian people at a game on a Sunday. Mm. It was part of their culture, you know, to go to a game on a Sunday. And they were very passionate.
Huh. Wow.
And had long memories.
Yeah, I can imagine. You were at University of New Haven for quite a while, right? How did that end up happening?
Well, I had distant relatives. My father's cousins with the same name, Macknick, lived in Old Lyme, Connecticut. And he used to take me there in the summer to visit. And they had a farm, and I learned how to drive a car when I was 10 years old and milk a cow and all those kinds of things. So I always wanted, I said, when I had a family of my own, I would raise them in Connecticut. Even though I was, had been coaching at LIU for 3 years, an opportunity came at the University of New Haven to move to Connecticut with my two young daughters at the time. Mm-hmm. We took that opportunity. But to do so, to get that job coaching soccer, I also had to coach hockey.
Okay.
So I coached hockey for 3 years, and I could barely skate, but I had a smart enough to hire a really, really good assistant coach, who kind of ran the practices, and I ran the bench during the games,
and he could
worked,
skate.
It worked out pretty well.
Okay. And I'm trying to kind of figure out. There's so many other things chronologically. What then happened next in your soccer story?
Then the coaching schools came. In fact, it was Detmar Kramer was appointed by FIFA after the World Cup in Mexico. Mm. He came directly to the States, and hardly anybody knew about it or knew of him. Communications were not the same. And I got a call from Hubert Vogelsinger, who was coaching at Yale, which is in New Haven. He said, "You got to do this. You got to do this. Come to this coaching school."
Mm.
So we all, 17 of us, went up to Moses Brown School in Providence and took this coaching school. And it was a revelation.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and he became like almost like a god to us. I mean, I remember there were 3 weeks of 3 1-week sessions, and I did the goalkeeping lesson for my test. And Detmar obviously liked it. He said, "Can you come back week two and do it for next week's course?
Mm-hmm.
Come back in week three." So that's kind of how it all began. But that became a really important part of my life, because then almost every weekend, I was doing a clinic either for U.S. soccer or for NSCAA all over the country. I mean, we traveled and did clinics, went to Maine one time and did a clinic for 11 people. So it was, that's kind of how the reputation of a goalkeeper guy started.
Okay. And what year did your camp start?
1977.
Okay.
We started the camp. I had been working at everybody else's camp, and I was watching goalkeepers being abused. Even at Walter Chisowitz's camp, the All-American soccer camp at school, and I said, "Walter, let me do a goalkeeper camp in conjunction with your camp."
Hmm.
He and Gene, they pondered the thought, what are you going to do? There's nothing you can do with goalkeepers. What are you going to do for a whole week? All they are is put them in a goal and shoot at them. You know, I was trying to explain, no, this is how you train them and da-da-da. So I took the challenge that they did and said, okay, I'm going to do it myself. And along with my assistant coach, John Kowalski, at the time we started number one goalkeeper camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the first year we had 39 goalkeepers from 13 states. And the following year we had 240 from 39 states.
Mm.
And by the third year we expanded to Chicago and Texas. And at one time we were doing, we added strikers a little bit later on. We're doing 3,200 kids in the summer.
Wow.
It was unbelievable.
Who are some of the goalkeepers who've come through your camp?
Oh, man. My favorite, of course, is the late Dave Vannoli.
Yeah.
Dave was a camper for 5 summers and then became a staff member and traveled with us. Of course, he's passed away now. But Nick Raimondo, Matt Reese, Joe Cannon, Kevin Hartman, John Bush, all campers.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good group.
Yeah.
And just how many players, I guess, total do you think have come through your camps?
I have no way of knowing that, but between players and because back then we did registrations on 3x5 cards, and we don't have those cards anymore, but
right.
Somewhere near close to 80,000.
Really?
Wow. And with, if you combine staff, you know, so this being our 42nd summer, 85,000 individuals have been with us one in one shape or form.
Okay. And we haven't even talked about your refereeing career yet. What? How did that happen? I mean, this is not something where you were just kind of doing small games. You did an NCAA title game.
Yeah, well, while I was at LIU and doing my graduate assistantship, I was also director of intramurals.
Okay.
So as director of intramurals, I wound up refereeing everything. Basketball, volleyball, flag football, soccer. I loved refereeing. So then I moved to New Haven, and we were at a jamboree with eight college teams. Mm-hmm. And one of the referees, his name is Keith Johnson, who ran the Connecticut State Referees Association, came up to all of the coaches and said, tomorrow is the opening of the Connecticut State Soccer League season, and we don't have enough refs. Hmm. Would any of you like to volunteer to referee tomorrow? And so I say, sure. I raise my hand. And that was the start of it. So I refereed that game. I don't remember exactly, but there were good teams. Hartford Portuguese, Hartford Italians, New Britain Falcons. I mean, Vasco da Gama. There was serious soccer. Mm-hmm. So I refereed without taking a fitness exam and no rule book. And that's how it all began.
And did you develop a style when it came to refereeing, or is there a preferred way to go about things in your mind?
I think what served me well on the field as a referee was, you know, my playing background and coaching background. Mm-hmm. So I was able to feel a player's pain when there was an injury and say the right things and show the right amount of empathy. And from a coaching background, I knew, you know, what the expectations were of mm-hmm. a coach. And so I'm not saying I refereed by a different set of rules, but by a different set of emotions that really, really helped me. Mm-hmm. And then what really helped me too was the indoor game, where you had to be so fast with your decision making, mm-hmm. because there was like a decision to be made almost every 3 seconds, and you know, advantages played off the boards that you wouldn't think, mm-hmm. you know, the ball all of a sudden was at someone else's feet. So, and it brought you so close to the players in the indoor game that you had to. You had to have a relationship with them, and you saw the same plays, a six-team league in the early years. Right. So, and I was refereeing every weekend, so you knew the players by their first name, and they knew you by a lot of other names, but I guess I was a player manager, but not to the point where I sacrificed the laws of the game.
Okay, gotcha. And when you're introduced often on Fox Sports, they talk about you being a former FIFA match commissioner. Sometimes I wish they would explain more about what that is, because I don't know how many fans out there actually know what a match commissioner is.
Yeah, I tell you what, even when I was working for MLS in the referee department, and Ivan Gazidis, who's now with Arsenal, was my immediate direct report, and he came and said, U.S. Soccer has received a notice from CONCACAF that they're going to run a match commissioner's course in Trinidad and Tobago at the so-called Center of Excellence, and they would like to send one or more persons from the league. So I raised my hand, as did Nelson Rodriguez, and we both went down and took the course. It's a very interesting course, because what the match commissioner at the end of the day is FIFA's representative in charge of the integrity of the match. Mm-hmm. So you run the technical meeting, you know, where you decide what uniform colors are being worn, you know, and you discuss whatever rules, regulations, where the warm-up areas. You go to the team's practices to make sure they get their 1 hour practice walkthrough at the stadium. You get make sure the game starts on time. You make sure the referees are sequestered, and then not approached, and no gifts are exchanged. And then at the end of the day, you write a report, and you back in the early days you faxed it, and it was like 17 pages of a checklist.
Really?
Yeah, and it took forever. And some of the stadiums didn't have a fax machine. You had to do it at the hotel. We were talking, you know, CONCACAF. My first assignment was Trinidad, Tobago at Dominican Republic. And you know, you have this meeting and everything's going to okay, the ambulance is there and it's a dedicated ambulance. But then they don't tell you that if there's an accident outside and the ambulance leaves, there's not a second ambulance.
Oh, man.
So my first experience was a player getting hurt and not having an ambulance there. And it was, you know, they took him on a pickup truck.
Unreal.
And it was not very good for me. I don't know how I survived as a match commissioner for not ensuring that a second ambulance was available immediately.
Wow. Yeah. I know we're jumping around in time here, but there's various things popping up in my head. I realized this came a little after your 1990 World Cup experience with the U.S. national team. So, and also we should not ignore here in 1989, the year before that, you were an assistant coach on a U.S. five-a-side team that won a bronze medal at the FIFA World Championship. That had Tab Ramos and Peter Vermees on it, right?
Yeah. Not only Tab Ramos, Peter Vermees, Bruce Murray, Mike Windischman,
wow.
Eric Eichmann. We just had a reunion, kind of. Brent Goulet, Jimmy Gabara. Some of the players became the foundation of the 90 team that went to Italy, and some of them are still involved in soccer today. It was a great experience. John Kowalski, who was my assistant coach at New Haven and who I recruited as a high school player to come to New Haven, was very successful indoors with the Pittsburgh Spirit. So he got the job as the five-a-side coach. And we kind of revolutionized five-a-side because we were substituting on the fly, which they hadn't been done. And we even changed goalkeepers on a penalty kick situation, which no one had ever seen before.
Because we had Louis van Gaal.
Yeah. Actually, it was in Holland. The tournament was in Holland, and really? Franz Hook. By that time, I knew him. He was working my cams, so I had him as a backup assistant coach, unpaid nice. Assistant coach, and working out. So AJ Lakowecki was our goalkeeper, and he was kind of small and slight of frame. And in our first game, we tied 1-1, and their goal, the opposition goal, was a penalty that, you know, he couldn't save. So I said, we got to put in on a next penalty kick. We substitute AJ. We put in Dave Vannoli, much bigger. he covered practically the whole goal. And he saved the penalty the next time. And people went nuts. It was really good.
That's great. I mean, five-a-side, is it basically futsal?
Yeah, it became futsal.
Okay.
excuse me, the rules, you know, at first it was running time, and now they got stop time. They've changed a lot of the rules. They're much more strict with slide tackles and things of that nature. But basically, it was futsal.
And so that was 89, but at the same time, you're going through World Cup qualifying with the U.S. senior men's national team, which hasn't qualified since the 1950 World Cup. What was your role on that team?
Well, from the five-a-side World Cup, which we did very well with the bronze medal, then I went right to be assistant coach to Bob Gansler, and we had qualified in a group with El Salvador and Costa Rica and Honduras, and we, you know, to qualify for the World Cup, and I was his assistant coach. It was just Bob and I, so I wasn't only just the goalkeeper coach at that time, but you know, was the assistant coach, and we managed to qualify on the last day of qualifying with that magic game in Trinidad that everybody calls the, you know, Paul Caligiuri wonder goal game.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting on the bench and on the end of the field where that goal was scored. And as soon as Paul hit it, I jumped up and yelled, "Trouble!" And because I knew the sun was in the goalkeeper's eyes and the wind was behind him, going to hold up the ball. So everybody, you know, that ball went over the goalkeeper's head but bounced before it hit the net.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it had like such a parabolic curve to it. So, but I knew it from my goalkeeper experience that he was going to have trouble with it, just the way Paul hit it. And sure enough, that became the winning goal. But what really, and one of the things, if you ask about memorable moments, after the game, Sunil Gulati, who had just begun his U.S. soccer career, came into the locker room and, you know, shook my hand and said, thank you. And it really was not only, it was because Tony Meola got four straight shutouts in the last four qualifying games. And it, without that, those, if you look at the score, 0-0 and all, and then 1-0 in Trinidad, without those, his shutouts, we don't qualify.
Right. The World Cup itself in Italy, what stood out to you from that experience?
You know, we were in a tough group, Czechoslovakia, Italy in Italy, Austria, who at that time had a very strong team. And in the analyzation of that group, we felt if we were going to get any points at all, we're going to get them from Czechoslovakia. And they had, you got to remember, it's 1990, and it's about the time the Iron Curtain is, you know, there's revolution and solidarity and all of that. So there was real dissension in the Czech camp between the players who were still playing in Czechoslovakia and the ones that already had gotten out and were playing in Italy and other places. And they did not win a single warm-up game after they qualified. They had several in Europe. They didn't win any. Austria won all of them, including beating Holland in Holland. So, and you know, of course, we didn't expect to beat Italy in Rome. So we played an open game against Czechoslovakia, and we got hammered 5-1, and Tony saved even a penalty, so it could have been greater. And obviously we had to change our approach. The next game was against Italy in Rome. We had to go by bus because we were stationed outside of Florence. So, and I mean, that was an experience in itself, because every little town we passed, the Italian community would come out. Somehow they found out when the bus was coming. There was a helicopter above, and we'd get to an intersection, and the police would get out of their cars with machine guns and look around before we could cross the intersection. But all the people were going, showing two hands and 10 fingers, going, 10, 10, because they were going to beat us 10-0.
Oh, man. Yeah. That didn't happen that way.
No, and I tell you what, we lost the game 1-0, and there's a magic moment in the game where Bruce Murray has a free kick, and it dips right before Walter Zenga, he makes the save, and the rebound comes out to Vermes, and he shoots him and hits him in the rear end. And we could have had a tie there that would have kept us still alive against Austria. And, you know, Austria, we played a reasonable game. We lost 2-1.
Yeah, I think people in many ways remember that World Cup as just that's what got the ball rolling again sort of in the modern era by qualifying. But I remember as a kid, that was the first World Cup I watched. And I remember watching the Italy game and just being pretty proud that like this U.S. team of really young guys that didn't have much international experience didn't get the doors blown off them by this great team.
You know, by the middle of the game, the 50,000-60,000 Italian fans were beginning to cheer for us. You know, they were not happy with their own team's performance. It was a great experience for us.
So I realize I'm skipping a lot of years here, but and correct me and feel free to add something if I am missing something really important here. But I do want to take some time to talk about what you do with Fox Sports, because my sense is that you've had this amazing career where you've been involved in so many different things, but that once you started doing television, that you might get recognized more now than you used to in the past. And I'm just also curious to get a sense of how you approach, how you got this job and how you approach how you do it.
Well, let's start with how I got the job.
Okay.
So working for MLS in the Department of Officiating Services, where I kind of coordinated the referee programs of both Canada and U.S. with MLS. So I was the customer. MLS is the customer of their referee departments at the time, and I was in charge of customer services.
Gotcha.
So, and also the disciplinary committee. But a gentleman by the name of Michael Cohen ran the broadcast department at MLS, and every year he did a broadcast seminar for all of the play-by-play and color commentators for all of the clubs and the national broadcast teams. And they would come to Florida or Vegas or some, you know, attractive place, and there'd be a seminar. And Michael would always ask me, would I be able to do a one-hour session on the rules and any changes and interpretation and the role of the disciplinary committee. And I would, and he would make me do it after lunch, because that's when everybody is still sleeping. He said the food puts them to sleep, and my job was to wake them up. So I would bring, you know, videotapes of outrageous tackles and stuff that happened at MLS, and bring a whistle and flags. And, you know, one time I had Thomas Rangan standing in front of the group. You know, I said, Thomas, show me the difference between an offside flag and a foul flag. And, you know, it was, coaches don't know that. So we had a lot of fun. And so I did that, you know, almost every year for, I don't know, maybe 15 years. Mm. So when Fox began the sport networks, Fox FS1 and FS2, Michael became a consultant for them because of his experience in MLS. And Fox had already had the NFL. And, of course, they had Mike Pereira, who everybody knows, who does the rule interpretations for football. And they said, well, we need somebody to do something like that for soccer. And Michael said to the people at Fox, well, I have your guy. And so I got had a screen test.
Yeah?
Yeah. So it was right after one of their broadcasts. Rob Stone was at the desk, and they brought me in and sat me at the desk and showed me video clips that I had not seen before. And I had to analyze on the fly those clips. And they said, thank you very much. And then maybe 2 months went by before I got a phone call and said, you have the job. And their explanation to me was that they thought that the way I handled it versus the way others handled it, because they did interview quite a few others, was that my teaching background from the university, that's really what they wanted. Someone who would not only, you know, wouldn't just criticize the rule or the interpretation or the referee, but actually explain it and teach it, you know, to the people who are watching soccer, and to do it in a way not to insult them, like they, you know, that, because soccer's been around now a long time in the country. You can't talk down to the fans. You gotta, you know, they're sophisticated fans. So that's how I got the job.
Okay. And how do you approach doing that job? Like, what's it like during a game when you're working it?
Well, believe it or not, you know, at the end of a game, I'm exhausted because I'm staring at it. And you know, I've got my rule books at my side and everything is underlined. And you know, if I do get a chance to speak about anything that happens, you know, you have to use the right choice of words, you can't make a mistake because you're expected to be, you know, right 100% of the time. So there's pressure, and it's pressure when I'm in the studio in L.A. But what a lot of people don't know is that I have a studio at home, as do you, in fact, Grant. And so I'm watching the game, and I have my computer, and I'm constantly emailing the producers, and you know, they're giving whatever I say if they think it's appropriate to the talent, and saying, Dr. Joe says, and they often use it without saying, we heard from Dr. Joe. So I take, you know, I'm happy about that. I'm not looking for that credit because I'm performing a service. And sometimes they say, oh, well, Dr. Joe said. And sometimes I get a phone call, get in front of the camera. We need you right away. So, you know, like you, I watch the game in a shirt and tie in my pajama bottoms.
Well, I think it really adds something to the broadcast. And I think, I mean, am I right in thinking that soccer, maybe even more than the NFL or other sports, has a need for something like this?
Well, everything is open to interpretation in soccer, you know, and it's a very difficult game to referee. It's gotten very fast and very physical at times, and there's players who are attempting to dupe the referee in situations, simulation and others. And it's all a question of angles. And so for years, the game has been refereed by one gentleman or lady with a whistle and two assistants with a flag. And now people are understanding that that's not enough. So UEFA, for example, a couple of years ago, put two more referees involved in the game on the end line. And they at first were, their job was only to be like a goal judge, because we've had incidences of the ball hitting the crossbar coming down and you couldn't tell with the naked eye if it's a goal or not. And even they couldn't do the goal judging properly, even though they were properly positioned. So that kind of developed into, they became assistant referees patrolling the penalty area at each end. And even that's not enough. And so now we've got video assistant referee coming out, and they've been testing it in several countries, including MLS here, Germany, Italy, and it's been a Confederations Cup. Right. It's been not as easy as it looks, even with video assistant referee. So, and now they're saying it's almost 100% sure video assistant referee will be used in this World Cup. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of happy about that, because it just gives a lot more talking points for everyone involved, because it's still a human being looking at a play and having an opinion.
You spent so much time, this is so much a part of your career, the idea of, you know, refereeing. If you could make any changes to the sport in terms of how it's refereed, officiated, what would they be?
Well, right away, without giving a lot of thought to it, I know soccer's got a problem with concussions. Mm-hmm. And FIFA has put in a concussion protocol where the referee now doesn't restart play for as long as 3 minutes to deal with a potential head injury that might be a concussion. But I would allow a substitution on that that doesn't count when that happens. Allow a substitution where the player who's got the head injury could be properly analyzed as to whether he or she has a concussion, and that could take a half hour. Mm-hmm. Before proper medical personnel say, okay, you can or cannot go back in the game. And if they say that person can go back in the game and the coach wants to, then okay. And that the substitute, you know, they haven't been playing with 10, they'd be playing with 11, and that player would, the other one would come out, and that wouldn't count as a substitution. Mm-hmm. I think that would have really helped the whole concussion protocol scene. And the other thing is with overtime, and you know, they've now, in March, there'll be a meeting, IFAB meeting, where they will discuss whether to make it a permanent rule change, a fourth substitution in overtime, mm-hmm. and I think that's even not enough. You've all 23 players on a roster now dress. It's not like you only, in the past, you can only dress 16 and everybody, the others were in the stands. They're all on the bench. And the true, in my mind, the true strength of a soccer nation is in the numbers of quality players they have. So if you have 23 dressed and you're going into a 30-minute overtime period, why shouldn't they all play? Not re-entry, go in, go out, but let them all play and let's see what the true strength of your soccer is in the country.
Interesting. One thing I have to ask during this is, I've gotten so used to calling you Dr. Joe, and that's what everyone calls you on television. Where does the doctor come from?
Because I was in education, and if you wanted to achieve tenure at a university, you had to go for an advanced degree. So I went first as an experiment out to Utah, where they were had a major called Leisure Studies Recreation. And I went summer of 71, summer of 72, and then a 9-month residency, and transferred 26 points also from NYU and got a PhD in leisure studies. So that's where the doctor comes from. And interestingly enough, my dissertation was called Recreation in Retirement Villages. So, and that's in 1973. And I toured 10 retirement villages in the Southwest and analyzed their programs against the research against senility and successful aging. And it was way ahead of its time. It got published in Golden Years magazine and Senior Living magazine. And then when I got back to the university, the athletic director resigned. And since I was the only one in the department with a PhD, they asked me to be interim. And then I got the job, and I never used that degree in the field that it was.
Wow.
But that's where the Dr. Joe came. And I have to say that Rob Stone, who we all know as the host of soccer on Fox, I mean, he perpetuated that character with some of his Doctor in the House and other kinds of things. And I like it. So you know, he's made fun of it, but it's been good fun, and I enjoy it.
One other thing I just wanted to see if you were aware of. You've gotten so popular, you have a parody account on Twitter called Faux Dr. Joe. You have a real account as well, I should add.
Yes.
But this, it's a, I think, an affectionate parody account on Twitter.
At times.
That seems to have an interest in Cuddy Sark for some reason.
And I don't drink scotch. but I don't know who it is. There are times I say, you know, I hope people understand that what that wasn't me.
Yeah.
You know, but it's for the most part been respectful.
Yeah.
And I have my suspicions that it's somebody at Fox, but I don't know.
This is a sign that you made it, I think, when you have parody accounts on Twitter. Now, in Russia for Fox for the World Cup, what exactly will you be doing and how many games will you be working?
I think I'll work them all. And that's going to be very unique because in the group stage, there are some days with three games and some days with four games.
Right.
So, and I'm telling you, one game is a challenge. So it's going to be very interesting. But if something happens with VAR or otherwise in the fourth game of the day, I'm sure that if an explanation is needed, they're going to call on me. So I'm going to be watching all the games. Yeah.
Wow. That's going to be an impressive work output,
especially in the early rounds.
Yeah. We're finishing up here. I appreciate you taking this much time. This has been a fun conversation.
Thank you.
But we're actually recording this in Orlando, and you're being inducted into the National Soccer Hall of Fame, and your wife Barbara's here.
Yes.
Your family.
Yes.
Is here. How many family members are here?
Well, I have between family and friends more than 60. The Federation wouldn't give me another table. And, you know, not all of them have been invited. So I don't know where they're coming from. You know, but they're coming from Arizona, Chicago, Milwaukee. You know, and what's really cool is I've got a high school teammate, a college teammate, college coaches from both universities that I've been associated with. People from the referee community, Michael Cohn will be here, from, you know, who got me the job at Fox, and other folks. So, yeah, and, you know, and the really fun part is I'm being inducted as a builder,
mm-hmm.
I guess because of the many roles that I've played that you've explained. And I went to Brooklyn Tech, which is noted for putting out engineers and architects. And if I learned anything at Brooklyn Tech, the one lesson I learned is that no way did I want to be an engineer. So that's probably how else I got into soccer, because sometimes there's such a thing as a successful failure.
Well, if this is a successful failure, I would put the emphasis on the successful. Thank you so much, Dr. Joe Magnick, for joining me. Congratulations on your entry into the Hall of Fame. You've touched a lot of people in this sport, and I'm glad people are hearing your story.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure, and I appreciate everything you do for soccer in America.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Dr. Joe Magnick, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it wherever you get your podcast. It really does help us if you do. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available for free now on SI.com. Recent guests include Heath Pierce, Vaishali Bardwaj, Rob Stone, and Chris Ahrens. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.